I'm very happy to say I have in the studio with me Dr. May R. Barenbaum, who is the department head of the Department of Entomology at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. It's great to have you back on the show.
Always a pleasure to be here.
It's been a while, though, since you were on, I think, and I don't think you've been here in person.
I think it might have been a different radio station.
Well, it was in a different location.
A different location.
Yeah. Because, and maybe it was a different radio station. It's been that long.
Yeah.
Rob, you having issues here tracking down Jeff?
Yes.
Oh, okay. Well, you got two numbers. You've tried both of them, right? We've got a cell number and the landline. You've tried both? You're working? Oh, he's getting to it. Okay. Just want to make sure. I know. Because we've got lots of guests here on the show. And I'm impressed by me, May. May I call you May, by the way?
Please, absolutely.
You have the best email address ever. If you write to Dr. May R. Barenbaum, her email address is M-A-Y-B-E, maybe.
First five letters of my name.
Whatever, blah, 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 you know. But I love it. But that's maybe. I love it. I want that email address. So the last time you and I, I was going to say I was impressed myself because I said, what are you doing in Chicago? And she said, I'm being on your show. So you drove all the way or came up. I don't know if you took the train, whatever. But you came all the way up here to be on the radio program.
Yep.
Wow. Where's my bell? All right. It's such a pleasure to have you here. The last time you and I saw each other in person was at a seminar about bees in McHenry County. Mm-hmm. And I remember we had some interesting conversations there. I just enjoyed talking to you so much. And that was just about the time that colony collapse disorder became a phrase that was being bandied about.
Public awareness finally, embraced the problem.
Well, you know, the scientists had embraced it at that point, but and researchers, I'm not so sure about the public, but the public has caught on.
Mm-hmm.
And now people ask about it. Before we get going in our conversation, I want to go to line three and bring in Jeff Pettis, who's a research leader in bee research at the USDA Agricultural Research Center in Beltsville, Maryland. Jeff, are you with me?
Yes, I am. Good morning. Pleasure to be here.
Pleasure to have you again. I interviewed the two of you. I did a story on CCD, I want to say 6 years ago, for Chicagoland Gardening Magazine. I talked to both of you, and at the time, I said, so what's wrong? Why are bees disappearing? Well, and everybody does, the lay people come in and say, so what's going on? And at the time, you guys said, well, it's complicated. We really don't know, and it's complicated. Dr. Barenbaum, would you say the same thing today?
Yeah, I think so. I know the public is clamoring for a single satisfying explanation, but there is no scientific basis for identifying a single satisfying.
All right, you're going to throw science out here, and people are going to get upset.
Yep,
because they do. And I'll tell you right now, I wrote about it on my website, mikenovak.net. If you go to this week's show, and I tried to encapsulate everything that's been going on, but I mean, you could write a book about it right now, and I'm just a radio guy. But one of the things I have noticed is that there are people who've decided to skip the science, okay? And those are the and I'm going to make some environmentalists angry here because they have decided they know what's causing it, and it's neonicotinoids, which is a kind of pesticide that has been used roughly for about 10 years. And it's been and rapidly become the most popular pesticide in the world, or a group of pesticides in the world. And yet, Dr. Barenbaum, you would say, hold your horses, I would imagine.
Well, evidence began to accumulate, starting about 2010, there was a study, well, actually 2009, a study actually examining what pesticides bees are encountering. And shockingly, the number of pesticide detections in bees and in hives and hive products is astonishing. Over 121 different pesticides and metabolites have been documented. Dr. Pettis is more, he's been involved in these studies directly. But what these studies have shown repeatedly is that the neonicotinoids are part of what appears to be a very toxic mix. So isolating one component of a complex melange is not necessarily going to establish a cause-effect relationship. And in fact, neonics, in terms of contaminants, are difficult to document. And the number one most frequently encountered contaminants in many of these studies have been the pesticides that the beekeepers themselves put into the colony to kill the parasitic mites, the varroa mites. And a lot of problems associated with bees and beekeeping can be linked to these mites.
So you're saying that the beekeepers themselves are contributing to the problem, possibly?
Not really. I'm just saying that there is certainly, if you're going to indict a particular pesticide, if you look just objectively at what's in the hives, not surprisingly, what's in the hives includes what beekeepers put in the hives. And you can't really blame them because these there are very few alternative pesticides that have been approved for use in hive against honeybees. It's very difficult to design a pesticide that will kill the parasitic mites without harming the honeybees, because bees and mites are both they're fairly closely related. They belong to the phylum Arthropoda. They are both arthropods. Most pesticides are designed to kill insects and spare vertebrates. But when you really narrow down the target and you're trying to differentiate between two closer relatives, that makes it difficult. Moreover, the mites evolve very quickly. They are now resistant to the two approved pesticides, historically approved pesticides, tauflavalinate and Cumafos. And the EPA just recently approved use of an older acaricide, a mite-killing compound, Ametraz. But there are not many weapons in the arsenals that beekeepers can use to control varroa mites. And varroa mites are important because they suppress the immune system of the honeybee, and they are also carriers or vectors of many of the viral diseases that Dr. Pettis and others have documented clearly are afflicting America's honeybees.
That's May R. Barenbaum, Dr. May R. Barenbaum from University of Illinois. I also have on the line Jeffrey Pettis from the USDA Agricultural Research Service in Beltsville, Maryland. And still on hold is Zach Browning. Zach, I know you're listening. I'll get to you in a second. But I want to go to Dr. Pettis because you were involved in a study that got released recently and brought up something that nobody was talking about until recently, which is fungicides. Can you tell me a little bit about this study that you did with the University of Maryland?
Sure. Before I go there, I'll just quickly say that Dr. Barenbaum is correct, that things that beekeepers use to control parasitic mites are one of the things we're fighting in hives. It's a case of damned if you do, damned if you don't. If you don't control varroa, you don't have a hive that's alive. And if you use some of the products, then you end up with residues and wax. And as she pointed out, we have a complex mix of things within the hive. And yeah, this most recent study, we looked at, I think, 10 different crops, and we trapped the pollen coming into the door, the front door of those hives. And the surprising part was that the fungicides coming in on pollen were causing adverse effects. They were causing an interaction between a parasite that infects the gut. Nosema is the name. It's a gut-infecting parasite. When they fed on the pollen that contained the fungicides, then they were more susceptible to this one particular pathogen, Nosema. So fungicides weren't necessarily on people's radar that much, and this study just highlights the complexity of bee health somewhat, and also that in most environments, there are things out there that could harm bees, and in this case, fungicides were pointed out.
By the way, I have to throw this in, Jeff. I just got a tweet from one of my listeners who writes, "Go Beltsville, Maryland, and Jeff!" She's out your way, and she's listening to the show, so she appreciates.
Thanks, Mom.
No, it's not Mom. So you've got fans out there. All right. You know, it's what we're getting to is the question I started with, which is it's very complex. However,
people hate that answer. They hate that bee health is complex, but it's this huge superorganism sampling of, you know, 5 square mile radius or something. I mean, they're sampling the environment. There's all these interactions in the hive, and there's multiple things going on at one time. So yeah, it is complex.
But something that you said to me, Dr. Barenbaum, 7 years ago, has stayed with me, and I don't know whether I misinterpreted it, but I want to make sure I understand this. At that time, and perhaps I misunderstood, you said something about the bees' genes, a couple of things. One is that they had, as I recall, half of the genes necessary to repel or to deal with these kinds of products. Well, what's that all about?
Okay, in October 2006, the honeybee genome was fully sequenced and published. That's every gene that goes into making up a honeybee. There are two big surprises that came out of the Honeybee Genome Project. One was that honeybees have far fewer genes for detoxifying poisons than other insects. So,
why do you think that is?
Well, we'll get to that in a minute.
Oh, okay. Sorry.
Other big surprise is they have far fewer genes for dealing with diseases, immunity genes. And that raised the question, why do bees have this astonishing deficit in protecting themselves against environmental threats? Well, one reason is, Dr. Pettis alluded to, that bees are not like most other, they're certainly not like most other insects, and they're not like many other organisms because they have this very sophisticated social behavior. A colony of bees is actually a superorganism. It isn't just a community with bees. You can't really compare a colony of honeybees to, say, the city of Chicago or, I don't know, Rosemont, smaller cities, so 30 to 50,000 individuals. They're all related, and they all work together altruistically. So this ability to deal with problems by cooperating with your relatives may have been a contributing factor to, for example, the loss of immunity genes. Honeybees have the capacity to deal with an infection by raising their hive temperature, just like our bodies deal with an infection by developing a fever, raising the temperature. They have a colony-level fever. They all act together to generate heat and raise the temperature, and that actually kills pathogens. They collect resins from trees around the hive that have antimicrobial properties. So collectively, they produce this material called propolis, which is derived from tree resins, which kills microbes. In terms of the pesticides, there are two possible answers. One is that they have evolved historically in the context of a very chemically benign environment. They are pollinators. They're mutualist partners with plants. So plants produce nectar for the sole purpose of rewarding a pollinator. No poisons for the most part. There are some toxic materials, but in terms of plants, plant tissues, nectar is about the safest thing you can eat. Pollen, too. These are rewards for pollinators. Plants fill up their leaves with all kinds of poisons. If you smoke tobacco, you know that. If you drink coffee, you know that. You're dealing with a neurotoxin called caffeine. But pollinators, mutualists, live in a much more chemically beneficent environment. So historically, they've not had chemical challenges like the ones they're now facing in this modern agricultural ecosystem that they function in, where they're introduced in many different ways to synthetic organic pesticides that humans put into the environment, including not just insecticides, but fungicides. The other aspect of why they may have fewer detoxification genes is they may also collectively use behavior to deal with these poisons. For example, people know bees use nectar to make honey. They may not know they use pollen. They don't eat raw pollen for the most part. They process it into a food that is called bee bread. It's kind of a mix of nectar, of honey and pollen that's fermented, actually. So this process of processing the honey, injecting enzymes, making some biochemical conversions, and then storing it, dehydrating it, reducing the water content from about 90% to 18%, and then letting it sit in the hive at 95 degrees for 4 or 5 days, all of this processing helps reduce the toxin level. The same thing with bee breads is fermentation, just like we pickle things to preserve them, may reduce the toxins. So behaviorally, they have developed mechanisms for processing natural toxins.
But it
synthetic toxins are a little more challenging.
Okay, and that's the point. These are synthetic toxins. And something else you said 7 years ago, and I'm glad I didn't get the first thing wrong, because I did remember it correctly.
Yep, you did.
The other thing you said is nothing in the history of the development of bees has prepared them for organophosphates or neonicotinoids and the other chemicals we've put out there.
Absolutely. And everything together in the chlorothalonil, the fungicide that Dr. Pettis and his colleagues found. This is very, very old-style chemistry with using carbon-chlorine bonds. So this is typical of the structure of chemicals like DDT and methoxychlor and other really, you know, old-style chemistry. And this carbon...
Is that old-style in a good way or bad way?
No, no. These were the bad guys. This is what led to, you know, Silent Spring and EPA. And these are incredibly environmentally persistent. And one reason they're persistent is that carbon-chlorine bond is very hard for organisms to break down because in the terrestrial world, you don't see that bond very often. We humans can create it in the laboratory, but... other than in marine environments where there's a lot of chlorine floating around because salt water is sodium chloride, terrestrial organisms don't process that very well. So it's not at all surprising that there are non-target impacts of these fungicides.
That's Dr. May Barenboim from University of Illinois. At this point, I want to bring in Zach Browning and Ted, who's got a question from Melrose Park. Hang on, we're going to get to you in just a second, but let me introduce Zach Browning to the conversation. He's a fourth-generation commercial beekeeper and honey producer out of North Dakota. With his brothers, operates over 20,000 hives for honey production. I talked to one of your guys the other day, Zach, and he said, well, maybe it's down to 19,000, something like that.
Go ahead. Hard to keep tabs sometimes.
Well, that's a lot of hives.
Yeah, we don't do inventory every day. I'll tell you what, it is a challenge, and I do want to report there's some progress here because the answer that we're getting when we're asked what's going on with the bees has moved from, well, it's a mystery, to at least now it's complex. And we know there's a lot of factors involved, but complex is a better word than mystery. What it really comes down to is stress and how much can the organism endure and where is that stress coming from? Well, I think, you know, Dr. Pettis and Dr. Barenboim have already touched on a lot of it. The honeybees are stressed performing their roles as pollinators. And when they're not pollinating, they're kind of like orphan tenants of rural America. And rural America usually still means agricultural systems that are, in many ways, toxic soups. And bees really are dealing with three major stressors. Pesticide exposure is one of those, not necessarily the prominent one, but it is definitely one of those. Varroa and the host of pathogens that are vectored in by the varroa mite are another factor. And one we really haven't touched on today is habitat loss.
Yes.
And you know, honeybees are not unlike many of the other organisms out there. They have to derive their nutrition from the environment. If they're required to find only crops that are either GMO crops or pesticide-treated crops as food sources, then they're not only exposed to those areas when they're treated, but they're also potentially getting a cocktail of poison in the pollen and nectar that is exuded by those plants. And not to mention the fact that the GMO crops in particular, because they are treated with herbicide so frequently and so thoroughly, are really devoid of any other potential diversity. And so there's just not enough flowers. And so sometimes it comes down to the simple situation that we all kind of dismiss. And, you know, bees need flowers not just to make honey, but to get their food. And that's really what makes healthy bees. And if you have a healthy bee, then it might have the ability to metabolize or absorb more pesticide. It might also have a healthier immune system, more fat bodies that would help it to survive through the winter, and all of those critical components for good health.
Well, you know, one of the, you mentioned the loss of habitat. One of the things I understand is that the hedgerows are disappearing, and this is where the bees used to get a lot of their nourishment, and now they're being wiped out. And, you know, I was talking to your partner the other day, or your associate, Zach, and, you know, he was saying that farmers are out there trying to squeeze every nickel they can, so they'll take the hedgerow area, and they'll and if they eliminate all of them, they can plant more crops, and they can make a get a few more bushels in. And in the long run, that sounds like that might be really harmful to bees.
Yes, the tree lines that were, you know, developed and planted by the Conservation Corps back in the 30s as a buffer from the Dust Bowl erosion are now succumbing to commodity pressure. We're losing those environments and the floral diversity that was within those. We're losing the conservation land. In the last 5 years, we've lost 10 million acres of CRP in the upper Midwest. And we're seeing wetlands and native prairies all tilled and converted to commodity farming. And, you know, who'd blame the farmers with the type of prices that we're seeing nowadays? But we're just not leaving any wild places or any habitat for the bees or for the other, tenants of those ecosystems. And it's no big surprise that they're suffering.
I just like to speak up, and share the blame. It's not lay it all on the farmers, because they're suburban homeowners.
Yes.
Who plant lawns and ornamental varieties that have no pollen or nectar contribute to this loss of resources. Mystifying to me, at least, management of roadside rights of way, which eliminate blooming flowers just for some arbitrary concept of highway beautification.
Oh, are you talking about planting turf along highways?
Yeah,
that sort of thing?
And yeah, or why? I mean, it's certainly justifiable to maintain visibility, but why roadsides have to be strafed and reduced to biological deserts is another practice.
And a lot of people call lawns biological deserts.
They absolutely.
And here's one of the problems is when I go to a garden talk, people say, how do I get rid of clover? And I say, why are you trying to get rid of clover?
Good for you.
What is wrong with you? It attracts pollen. No, well, you know, come on.
And it fertilizes the lawn.
I know, it's taking nitrogen out of the sky for free, putting it in your soil for free. It's producing pollinator attracting flowers, and there are people out there who tell you, maybe Zach, you agree that the white clover honey is the best honey in the world. I don't know.
Well, certainly from a North Dakota perspective, it is. but that's an issue. It's an attitudinal barrier that has been fostered by many, many years of trying to produce aesthetically pleasing yards and ball fields and on and on and on. And May's right. It's not just farmers. It's everybody. We all have a stake in our environment and what's available to grow food, and we have to consider that. I think it's also policy. We've got crop insurance that is allowing crops to be planted on land that should never really support it. And those are places that perhaps could be left for pollinators and for other animals.
Well, this is all part of that farm bill discussion, isn't it?
Well, yeah, as well as the conservation policy within that. You know, we're losing those critical CRP lands. In the last farm bill, we really emphasized and prioritized conservation, but we didn't invest in it. We invested in other parts of the agricultural systems, like the crop insurance. Is it any big surprise that farmers aren't rushing out to enroll land into conservation? There's just not enough profit there.
Yeah, and we don't. You're right. We don't push it. And I can't. Do I think that this current Congress will pass some enlightened law in the next couple of months regarding farmers? No, it's not going to happen. We have a bunch of dunderheads in Washington. So, that's when you say it's complex, it just keeps getting more and more and more complex. I want to reintroduce everybody, because I realize I haven't. Dr. May Barenbaum is in studio from the University of Illinois. Zach Browning, you just heard, is a fourth generation commercial beekeeper out in North Dakota. And the name of the company, it's Browning Honey Company, right?
That's right.
Jeffrey Pettis, Dr. Pettis, is with the USDA Agricultural Research Service in Beltsville, Maryland. Jeffrey, you've been quiet for a little bit here. Anything you want to bring up?
I have a number of things. But, well, first I'll just speak a little bit just to what Zach and May touched on as far as forage and availability. What we have to do, because I'm from the Department of Ag, we have to find a way to balance modern agriculture, and we need everything from these large scale farms with, you know, that are growing things like corn, rice, and wheat at a large scale, all the way down to the backyard or the community garden. We need all of that to meet our growing food need. But we have to, even with the large agricultural settings, I think unfortunately it's going to take a national effort to get some habitat back into those larger farming systems. So I think we can do it. I'm not going to speak about the Congress and what they do or don't do, but basically, we're going to need a concerted effort, CRP and others, to get some useful vegetation for all kinds of wildlife, pollinators, pheasants, birds, ducks, whatever, get that back into the environment. Mm-hmm. And the other thing I'd just like to touch on real briefly is that some of the talk about pesticides, and May touched on it brilliantly, was that bees evolved feeding on two pure products, which nectar is really pure, and pollen, by and large, is pure. And the reason there's a lot of attention to the neonicotinoid group, the systemics, is that we can find them even at low levels in nectar and pollen, particularly in pollen. So it's a little troubling that even at very low levels, that's the food that bees and other pollinators are using. So that's the reason a number of people are doing studies on looking to see if they're there and see if they're causing harm. And what we're finding is that, yeah, they're there sometimes in such low levels, but we're finding a lot of other things in the mix as well. So, yeah.
This is the Mike Novak Show on Chicago's Progressive Talk. Ted's been waiting very patiently on line one. You're on the Mike Novak Show. Good morning. Ted? Are you there, Ted? Well, maybe he wasn't waiting as patiently as I thought. Ted, you sure? All right. 773-763-9278 is our telephone number if you want to jump into the conversation. All right, let me pose a ridiculous question here. And I think, Rob, let's see if we can get Dr. Whalen, and I think he's working on that right now, from Michigan State University. All right, if we're causing all these problems, you talk about all the substances that are found in this very pure, what was once pure, nectar and pollen, why don't we just ban certain products? Why? I mean, would the whole agricultural system of the world collapse if we didn't have neonicotinoids, or if, you know, we did something else? What are we talking about here?
I don't know who wants to field this one, but
go ahead.
In terms of precedent for bans, Europe.
I mean, Europe just did that. They banned neonics for 2 years.
Three neonics
for 2 years is what I meant to say. And that actually leads to my question, which is they practice the precautionary principle, which is they're saying they're erring on the side of caution and saying, well, we're not sure, like the three of you have been saying, we're really not sure. But just in case, we're not going to use these for 2 years. Why the heck can't the United States do that? And you and I talked 6 years ago, May, and I said the way it works in this country, or maybe you said it, was we throw out a chemical and then 10 years later we go back and say, maybe that wasn't a really good idea. So why can't we just do that here?
Well, part of the problem is it's not clear what to ban. Banning three neonics.
All of it.
I was being
facetious.
Remember that you're talking about Congress. EPA is a government agency, and there are many constituencies to whom Congress answers, I guess.
Yes.
Well, I recently heard from a pollinator advocate, a lobbyist, who refers to CCD as congressional collapse disorder. So maybe that's a little...
Ooh, I like that. Wait, where's... That gets a ding.
But U.S. agriculture, for better or worse, has evolved in the context of pesticide use. And the problem with banning three specific neonics is there are many other neonicotinoid products. And what's more alarming is there are many other products that are demonstrably worse than the neonics. And in fact, the neonicotinoids were introduced as being environmentally more compatible than some of their predecessors.
Since the organophosphates, perhaps?
Organophosphates are really nasty, and they have been used, they can be used systemically. One problem with the neonics, and not so much banning the pesticide, but the practice, the use of systemics violates 40 plus years of hard-earned knowledge of integrated pest management. And the same thing applies to the use of antibiotics. You do not use antibiotics prophylactically because you end up selecting for resistance among bacteria.
So you're saying here that the use of systemics, which is the neonicotinoids and others.
And fungicides.
And fungicides. It goes against the tenets of
IPM.
IPM, integrated pest management.
You don't treat a problem if you don't know you have the problem. It's very...
We're doing it prophylactically.
It's very seductive. It's insurance. These formulations and preparations are cheap enough that farmers can, and you can't blame them for wanting to, you know, look at the bottom line, apply these pesticides just in case.
Mm-hmm.
But... Again, the lessons of the 1960s showed clearly that just in case is not a really sustainable strategy.
Well, Jeff, were you going to jump in there too, or was that Zach?
Well, yeah, I was just echoing what May said about it. A lot of these products are being used as, we'll call it crop insurance. If you do X, Y, and Z, you treat the seed, you do this and that and the other, you'll end up with a set amount of yield at the end of the season, and the commodity prices are such that the farmer basically can't afford to not do that. But the other thing is we've gotten away from what used to be, we used to have an extension service in most areas of the country that advised the farmer. Most of that advice now is coming from other parties, shall we say, that have developed products that they can guarantee a good crop. But so they're encouraged, the farmers are encouraged to use these products even in the absence of the pest, which is what May was saying. I mean, we're using them prophylactically, we're using them just as insurance against what might happen. And we're resulting in overuse, basically.
So why, if we're overusing them, why don't we fine people? Why don't we pass? I mean, there is a bill that has been introduced by Earl Blumenauer of Oregon and John Conyers of Michigan called Saving America's Pollinators Act of 2013. And I assume that has a bee's chance in a spray of nicotinoids of surviving.
Well, let me just correct the term overuse. In this case, I meant overuse. It's being blanket applying seed treatment or whatever to every situation, which, like May pointed out, goes against integrated pest management. You're targeting the same pest in all parts of the country, and they may not even be a problem maybe every once in 5 years. So it's that type of overuse. They're using it actually according to the label, but that's a different discussion.
Yeah, but you're right. It's used to every situation, then it is overuse. It's the Mike Novak Show on Chicago's Progressive Talk, AM and FM. In case you just joined us, we're having a pretty intense conversation about bee loss. I want to bring in a couple of people. Let's go back to the phones. And guess who came back? It's Ted from Melrose Park. I'm glad you're back with us, Ted.
Boy, I hit my mute button by accident.
Oh, is that what happened? That's why you weren't there. Okay.
You have the most important show of the year.
This may be.
I want to take yours, and you probably turn it into a podcast already.
I'm going
but
to.
I learned all about bees down at the Garfield Park Conservatory. When we went down to see the plants out in the field, they had beekeepers. And they had hives with glass sides so you could actually see it in production, which was it's just at my tree. I have my neighbors bordering. Their backyards are on forest preserve property. And we're going to take at least three homes and set up beekeeping so I can get a hold of the dude way up out in the west, Browning, I think, and find out what he can bring to the table here. This has to be delivered to people in such a way you hit them in the head with a 2x4. And then you say, look, you must stop flushing your drugs because Terry at the Water Reclamation District said sooner or later that ends up in the ground, in the water supply.
Well, there's no doubt we've put a lot of different chemicals into our environment, and we do it with it's a holdover from the days when we thought we had endless amounts of land and water. I mean, my goodness, we used to dump our effluent into the ocean.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, who was speaking there?
I was. I'm sorry. I interrupted you.
No problem, Ted. Continue on. And then
in the General Assembly, I spent 18 years making laws and broke a few. But I learned when you're talking to a farmer and you're talking to a beekeeper, I'm not sure they can coexist. We have water problems all over this place.
They used to coexist. Let me put it that way. Didn't they used to coexist?
Exactly. We've got to get it right back there. The faster, the better. There is no one that has an anticipation clock ticking as fast as mine, I might suggest.
Mm-hmm. All right.
We've got to get back there because the farmers are tiling their fields, running the water faster into the streams, flooding downstate. It's just a great big vicious circle.
All right, Ted, I should carry on, make a story
out of it, and I'll take it out to my people. Have a great day. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And I'm going to put this podcast out there. There's going to be a podcast of this, and May, you had your hand up, and I think maybe Zach might want to comment as well.
Well, one of the reasons, the nature of the relationship between beekeepers and farmers really has changed over the past century, and part of that has to do with what Zach Browning referred to earlier, the loss of sort of unmanaged land, because along with the loss of that unmanaged land, the U.S. is experiencing a loss of native pollinators. So there are something on the order of 4,000 species of bees in North America. But because they themselves are facing challenges finding enough food and habitat to maintain themselves, U.S. Farmers are relying more than ever on managed pollination services. And at this point in time, the only reliable, deliverable managed pollination services are controlled by beekeepers. So Zach can speak more to the point of the rising price of colony rentals, because farmers have no alternative. 100 years ago, you could plant a crop and then the local insect fauna would take care of it for you without even, you know, a thought on your or preparations on your part. But we have there's an additional crisis that's ongoing, and that involves our native pollinator community. Honeybees are our premier managed pollinators, but pollination services historically have been contributed by a very diverse insect fauna, which is now experiencing losses.
You're talking about native pollinators as well, and are these pollinators under attack as well?
Well, one of the problems that we have that we don't have with honeybees, people haven't tracked them over time. But now that this awareness has been raised and people are monitoring, there is clear evidence that there are certain groups of native pollinators in big trouble, including 4 species of bumblebees, one of which may already be extinct. Bumblebees are terrific pollinators.
And of course, 50,000 of them died in Oregon. And I said earlier in the show, due to stupidity.
Stupidity, exactly.
Is what that was. Zach, did you want to comment before I bring in another caller?
No, absolutely, Mike. You know, May really made some good points. And, you know, back to the coexistence issue, there's the food supply to be considered. 90% of the crops in the U.S. at least get some sort of benefit from bee pollination. And a third of our food crops depend on bee pollination. And so you think about it in that context, that's mandated coexistence. If we don't work with those farmers, we don't have enough food to eat. And on the other hand, there's the unmandated coexistence, and that's where when we're not engaged in that commercial pollination job, we have to have a place to put those bees, and they're related because if we don't survive through the rest of the year, then we're not there to do the job next time. And so we can coexist, but it's changing, and part of the reason it's changing is because the new technology in chemicals and farming is not evaluated the same way. EPA looks at pesticides now with totally different modes of action and totally different chemistries, the same way they looked at DDT 50 years ago. And until some of those evaluation methods and standards change so that we can actually appropriately label and understand how these compounds work in the environment, we're going to have a continued problem and a lot of unknowns out there. That was part of the reason why the European Union decided to take some extra caution. But we have a unique problem here. We're not really comparing apples to apples when we're talking about Europe agriculture and what we have here, which is very large-scale farming, very, very high-tech farming, where we've created environments where there's very little plant diversity, which makes them very susceptible to disease. There's large acreages, which makes them very, very hospitable for the pests that we're trying to control in those crops. And because of that scenario, we're more dependent on chemical here than we are in Europe. And so it's a lot more difficult to say, well, let's just ban these products. We've got some real issues to deal with. Really what it comes down to is finding a way to bring sustainable practices to conventional farming. If we can do that, which we've made a pretty good effort at doing it this far, and that's why we're still surviving, then I think we can continue to coexist. But it takes understanding and commitment from everybody.
I want to bring in another call here. By the way, it's the Mike Novak Show on Chicago's Progressive Talk, AM and FM. Dr. Mayer Barenbaum is in the studio. Dr. Jeffrey Pettis is in Beltsville, Maryland. He's with the USDA Agricultural Research Service. And Zach Browning of Browning Honey Company out of North Dakota is on the line. Let's bring in Dave from Milwaukee. Dave, it's good to hear from you.
I could listen to you guys all day. What a wonderful show today, and very sad to me. Dr. Barenbaum, I had a class with you years ago back in Illinois with Bob Metcalf. I worked with Bettina Francis.
Oh, my goodness.
Folks. And still working on pesticide issues, both nationally and internationally. But I had a couple questions. These new, what they call pseudopyrethroids, these non-ester pyrethroids that are being sprayed around for mosquitoes and things, are those having an effect because they last longer in the environment? And the other question I had was, what are some of the other chemicals that they are still finding in pollen, and are they insecticides?
Well, with respect to the new generation of pyrethroids, one of the acaricides approved for use inside the hives is tauflavalinate, which is a pyrethroid. Bees are actually quite sensitive to pyrethroids in general, and the reason that tauflavalinate can be used in hives, it's slightly less toxic than the other pyrethroids, and in fact, we've shown in our research at the University of Illinois that pesticides interact with each other. They're synergistic interactions. Remember, there are fewer detoxification enzymes in the honeybee. When different substrates compete for access to the detoxification enzyme, you end up with synergism or enhanced toxicity. So,
isn't that to interrupt? I'm sorry, but isn't that one of our problems? Is that we don't look at how these various chemicals interact with each other?
Absolutely.
When we do a discussion of here's the toxicity of this such and such a chemical, that's it alone, and yet it's interacting with a couple of dozen or even more chemicals out there.
Yeah, as I mentioned, 121 different pesticides and metabolites. This was from Mullins et al. 2010, an excellent study that I think Jeff was a co-author on, very sensitive chemical analyses of residues. And what they found in the pollen nectar, pollen honey, bee bread, or bodies of the bees or wax included every class of insecticides, so carbamates, pyrethroids, neonicotinoids, insect growth regulators, chitin inhibitors, all of those were found. In addition, fungicides, multiple classes of fungicides, every kind of pesticide, actually, that you can imagine that's used in U.S. agriculture shows up in hives. So the potential for synergistic interactions is limitless.
Well, and I think that's a really important point. I mean, even at the most basic level, at least they should focus on additivity. Mm-hmm. Even if they don't know whether they make each other worse, just add them together toxicologically, and if you can do that. But the other comment I wanted to make, and then I'll hang up, was the comment about whether we can get along without bees. Almond growers, to rent bees for the almond growers in California is almost prohibitive. And at a prairie enthusiast conference up in Minnesota earlier in the year, there was a presentation on whether, 10 to 15 to 20% of land being put back into natural systems could, in fact, compensate for some of those losses. So, again, great show, and I'll hang up and listen. Thanks so much.
Thanks for calling, Dave. And unfortunately, we're just about out of time here because I have to I'm going to get to Jordan Parker in just a little bit. But I wanted you guys to kind of put this in perspective here. You're the folks studying this, but people listening probably want to know what they can do. And what would the recommendation be? Jeff, maybe let's start with you, Jeff Pettis.
Sure. Real quickly, the homeowner can do a lot in just reducing the use of their own pesticides. Pesticides used by homeowners, the label rate is much higher than the farmer ever uses. So that's one way. The other main way, I think, and this is for mostly honeybee keepers, but also for native pollinators, we've got to find a way to get some diversity back in the ag environment. And I think that may have to happen at the national level. We have to provide some incentives, but we've got to find a way to get some diversity and plant diversity back out in the ag environment. So we always need this big ag. We can go all the way down to smaller and smaller farms and more diversity like they have in Europe. But we're going to have to balance that need. So getting some nutrition back in the environment for honeybees and other pollinators, I think, is key.
Zach Browning?
Yeah, Mike, I think that trying to make this complex issue simple really comes down to commitment to research, better understanding of new pesticide technology so that we can implement the type of use recommendations, best management practices that are required in order to protect pollinators and other organisms. And then on the other side of it, I think that we all have to learn to engage in more sustainable practices throughout all of the resource ecosystem management scenarios, not just agriculture. Mm-hmm. And if we can do that, we can provide additional diversity and probably long-term sustainability that we can practice. And that's what I think we have to do right now in order to make a difference.
Jeff Pettis and Zach Browning, who you just heard, thank you so much, gentlemen. I hope we have this conversation again. I want to talk further about this. And thank you for being on the show this morning.
Thank you.
Thanks, Mike.
All right. Take care now. Bye-bye. And as we let them go, May, in a minute or so, what would you advise?
Keep caring. Right now, this is the issue of the moment, but these problems are not going to go away. And I'm incredibly gratified by the fact that people actually do care about bees and reevaluate weeds. I mean, weeds are actually wildflowers growing where somebody doesn't want them.
Yep.
And in fact, wildflowers do have a place and a function, not just in farms, but here in cities and in suburbs and in rural areas. So two things. Don't stop thinking about the bees and think a little differently about the weeds.